This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 4th of March 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, conventional and indeed hopeful wisdom has it that Donald Trump won't win over independent voters. But might he also have trouble hanging on to Republicans? After another rancorous GOP debate, the party grandees start strewing obstacles in front of Trump's bandwagon. My guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Jeffrey Kaufman will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including a once beloved Brazilian president spends an afternoon explaining his finances to the federales. Is Operation Car Wash about to clean up Lula? Contrary to most hope and expectation, the pseudo-ceasefire in Syria seems to be holding, at the very real risk of tempting fate. We'll ask if the beginning of the end is at least visible in the distance. And Justin Trudeau makes some comments about America's ignorance of the world, which would cause outrage if anyone in America knew where he was Prime Minister of. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Jeffrey Kaufman, the author and commentator, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University here in London. Welcome both. We will start with the United States, where there is, if you work really hard at seeing it, a reassuring aspect to the ascent of Donald Trump towards the presidential nomination of the party of Lincoln, Grant, and Eisenhower, which is that it surely disproves any notion that the United States is rigidly controlled by some shadowy, omnipotent right-wing elite, which, if such a cabal existed, would surely by now have sat Trump down in a sandbagged basement and informed him that he'd had his fun. This having not happened, Trump's remaining opponents has, of this week, started on him properly. 2012 also ran Mitt Romney delivered a smart and droll summation of Trump's manifold defects, and last night's GOP debate turned into rather a mugging. Not that Trump seemed to mind. Jeffrey, first of all, we are now seeing, I think, an intensification of a pattern that has been repeating for a while, which is that people point out all the terrible things about Donald Trump, all the vast myriad uncountable reasons why he is not remotely fit to be president of the United States, and it doesn't make any difference at all.
We used to call this Teflon when we talked about politicians that things didn't stick to, like the frying pan. This is beyond Teflon. I mean, this is really
Teflon-coated Teflon.
Well, this is Teflon-coated. This is incomprehensible because no matter how many lies, and let's not call them half-truths or mistruths. I mean, he lies, he makes up things, he doesn't care about the truth, he doesn't care about information, his mind's made up, he just speaks what he wants to say, and yet it seems to have no effect on the people who matter, which are the people who are electing, who are making the decisions in these primaries. It is astonishing. But let's be clear what we saw happen yesterday. We have a civil war in the United States. The Republican Party is at war with itself, with Mitt Romney declaring warfare on the man who wants to carry the mantle forward, with Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz hating each other, hating Trump. There is real anarchy within the Republican Party, and its very existence may well be at stake.
And yet, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Cruz, Rubio, and Kasich, Trump's three remaining contenders, all said they would back him if he won the nomination. Would it make any difference at this point if one of those figures just said, if this guy wins it, I am walking away, I am done with this party?
Oh, we're going to listen to something like that very soon. In fact, there is one hypothesis in the works is that Cruz and Rubio get together as a ticket, Rubio wins in Florida, and then we have a broker deal in the Republican convention. But of course, this is just part and parcel.
I don't buy it. They hate each other.
Let me finish. This is part and parcel of the cabal stories and all this Teflon over Teflon. We created Trump. All this, this spectacle in the media, all the half truths and the partial lies created this kind of personality, and now everybody's having to deal with this. This is absolutely terrible, particularly for the Republican Party. I don't see an end to this civil war. I think it's going to be be very difficult to stop Trump. I said it a year before when everybody else was saying, oh, this guy's going to blow over. He's here and he is more and more dangerous.
Jeffrey, I wanted to follow up that point you just were talking about how the fact that Trump can spout any demonstrable nonsense he cares to and it makes no difference. What has changed in, I guess, the 8 years since Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008 was massively undone when she told one slight whopper about having landed under sniper fire in Tuzla, I think, in Bosnia, and footage then emerged proving that no such thing had occurred. Whereas Donald Trump, to pick just one within the last couple of weeks, was cheerfully endorsing a completely imaginary war crime committed by General John Pershing. You know, it never happened. Obviously, it never happened. If it had happened, Pershing would have spent the rest of his days breaking rocks in the hot sun. Yet he says this, and he's applauded for it. What has changed? Have the times changed, is people's response to Trump different to people's response to Hillary Clinton?
You know, listen, I've been a journalist in American television for almost 20 years, and I have watched. You know, I moved to the U.S. from Canada in 1997. And what we have watched over the last 20 years is this decline of American discourse. And I think that this is a symptom of a society that has taken superficiality, celebrity, and put them on an altar and absolutely said, I don't want to think, I don't want to read, I want to read BuzzFeed and Upworthy on the internet because they make me feel good. Don't make me try to understand all that mess in Syria. You know, we saw this, you know, at the American networks in the Iraq war. Every time we put a story on Iraq, people left the channel. You can see it in the measurements. This kind of culture with the defunding of education in the United States, with the trivialization of media, which is more and more trying to emulate BuzzFeed and Upworthy, you are seeing just less and less intelligent analysis. You have to seek it out in places like the New York Times.
Which is a minority pursuit. Absolutely.
And so, you know, the great thing about Donald Trump is you don't have to think. And that's why he's succeeding. This is a turning point. And I think many Americans and many Republicans, many well-meaning conservative Republicans are just shocked to see this happening. But, you know, it's also a consequence of something that we see here in the United Kingdom, you see in France, which is that amidst all the prosperity of the last 20, 30 years, there is a huge, let's call it lower middle class, working class, whatever, constituency that doesn't feel its lot has improved. They're just struggling to keep their head above water. And whether it's Jeremy Corbyn on the left or Donald Trump on the kind of right or Marie Le Pen in France, they all have similar symptoms, which is this sense of frustration, alienation, anger. The political establishment doesn't represent me. And Donald Trump has managed to tap into that, and through his combination of billionaire glitz and celebrity and glibness, is just exploiting it. When you study history and you read about demagogues, you think, wow, what was it like to watch a demagogue in practice? Well, now we're seeing it up close.
We're there. In fact, let me quote Franklin Delano Roosevelt here. Back in 1938, he did warn us that in order to finish the seeds of Hitlerism, we would have to achieve freedom from want. We did not achieve it, as you just pointed out. And so those seeds out of that terrible milieu is emerging this new Hitler-like figure, as Noam Chomsky pointed out a week before.
And of course he's not, you know, I hate these comparisons to Hitler, but I think there is an element of national socialism in this. This isn't Germany in the 1940s, but this is the kind of early 1930s where you saw people rallying around something they didn't really understand because it was a way to vent their anger. And it really is terrifying. And, you know, this notion of him having his finger on the nuclear button of thinking that these simplistic solutions to the incredibly complex problems of both the domestic politics of the U.S. but the world economy, it is numbing to think that he could be the president of the United States in a year.
Well, on that cheerful thought, we will move seamlessly along on the subject of American populists whose business dealings may or may not stand rigorous scrutiny. Former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has had his collar felt by the feds. It's the most dramatic development yet in an immense corruption scandal which has enmeshed a sizable cohort of the country's political establishment. Lula was questioned for 3 hours, eventually released without charge, though his home and offices were also searched, and as is traditional in such circumstances, he denies everything. Oscar, first of all, this is part of Operation Car Wash, which is this huge inquiry into dodgy dealings between politicians and Petrobras. In the context of this investigation, how big a deal is this?
It is a big deal. One must approach this news in the same way one would a crime thriller. Look for the motive. Who would win the most, if we get rid of Lula da Silva? Well, the proof of that is in the fact that the real got up. All the economic interest showed happiness about the prospect of a right-wing opposition government in waiting. But make no mistake, and let me say it very clearly, what we are witnessing is a soft coup. Softer it may be, because now it has become too politically incorrect to send your Hawker Hunter jets against the presidential palace and let the president burn. But it is a coup nonetheless. In fact, there is a very important study just published by the main law school in Brazil, UFERJ, which proves how many of the arrests which have been done more recently in the car wash operation are unconstitutional. And you can also notice the way in which the very statement of the police says that that Lula would be would have the ultimate responsibility for having appointed the director of Petrobras. That may be the case, but that's political responsibility. It has nothing to do and cannot be the base of a legal prosecution. Then there is the case of the legal evidence. The evidence has to stand in court, and we have not had court proceedings. But Lula has already been castigated. A media spectacle has been made of him. And of course, the aim is to tarnish his reputation for the upcoming election.
Just to follow that up, though, Oscar, do you think this entire inquiry is entirely politically motivated? You can't think there's no case to answer?
Not all of it. Of course there is a case. There is a case of political responsibility. There is enough evidence to prove that members both of the opposition and the ruling party and other parties were implicated. But to take this investigation in the direction of arresting Lula for preventive reasons, when it is well known where he is, where his domicile is, he's not going to leave the country and so on. The aim there is to produce the sort of media spectacle that would tarnish his reputation. The aim there is to stop the Workers' Party from winning the next election.
Jeffrey, the thing that strikes me every time I read about the Petrobras scandal and its consequences, which we have been following fairly closely since it began, is a kind of, it may be naivety on my part, but a kind of incredulity that I'm not even sure what to call it, an operation of this extent could have grown so large without anybody noticing.
In terms of the corruption, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is really about emerging democracies and the effectiveness of checks and balances. And this is a problem not just in Brazil. It's throughout the continent of South America. It's really throughout Latin America. And you see this in Africa and in countries in Asia. It takes a very strong judiciary, a very accountable, transparent police force to actually stop this kind of behavior. And it happens even in mature democracies, as we well know. But this is the cancer of all of these emerging democracies, and it's what undermines their advance. What's so significant about this and the discrediting of Lula is that his election in 2002 represented the first modern transition from one party to another in Brazil's history. And so it was really significant that that the conservatives peacefully handed power to the Workers' Party and that government continued. Because after years of dictatorship in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, it took a long time for Brazil to restore democracy and build up the institutions of civil society to support that. This is undermining that. This suggests that there's still a lot of work to be done. It's very fragile. And make no mistake, Brazil is not just another country on the map. Brazil is the fifth largest country, both by geography and by population. Its GDP, depending on how you measure it, is either the seventh or ninth largest in the world. It is, you know, its population, 200 and something million. It is a very, very important player in the world economy. And you know, just 10 years ago, when I was covering Latin America, Brazil was, you know, we've heard this term, the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. Brazil was one of the great emerging economies of the world. Well, now it's in the worst economic recession or depression in the last 25 years. This is a really, really worrisome state for Brazil.
Oscar, what's your sense of where public reaction to, I guess, especially recent developments is trending in Brazil? If we sort of imagine a spectrum with fatalistic apathy on one end and torches and pitchforks on the other.
Well, there is polarization. We saw, protests beginning in front of Lula's house, in which, the Lula supporters were trading insults with the supporters of the opposition. That's part of the aim here, to polarize the position and the position of people in the country, and to tarnish the figures such as Lula as divisive. By doing so, you are precisely undermining the possibility of a transition between a right and a left that, let's face it, are quite moderate. I mean, we're not talking about some revolutionary nutter here, and yet the conservative opposition is trying to gain through media spectacle and through tactical use of a non impartial judiciary and the police what they could not gain and cannot gain in by elections.
Final thought on this from you, Jeffrey. Brazil is about, if I've done my sums right, 154 days away from discovering that the global scrutiny that comes of hosting an Olympic Games can be rather a double-edged thing, and there's a World Cup 2 years after that. How important is it for Brazil that they actually get all this at least partially nailed down before the torch is lit?
Well, I think they have some medical issues that are actually more important.
Indeed,
right?
So.
Now, the Zika virus, I think, is actually a more urgent issue for them in terms of people feeling comfortable going to Rio. This is internal housekeeping. I don't think that Olympic athletes and Olympic visitors are so much worried about whether Lula has had his hand in the Petrobras cash box. I think the medical issues are really much more important here.
But we will see protests
during the Olympics.
You can bet.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, we will attempt optimism about Syria, and Justin Trudeau tells the United States what to think, which will almost certainly prompt a grateful, humble thanks for his input.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a Monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, when a sort of ceasefire was announced 2 weeks or so ago, it was greeted with a certain amount of hollow laughter, some of it indeed broadcast via these very microphones. 2 weeks or so later, however, the sort of ceasefire is sort of holding. This is obviously far from a cue for celebration. It merely means that Syrians are dying in slightly smaller numbers than they might previously have been, but it might be reason for some hope. Oscar, first of all, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that violence is down 90% since the ceasefire started, which it did start properly a week or so ago. That is obviously coming down from a fairly high figure, that 90%. 10% of that is still pretty hideous. But, I mean, is this potentially a beginning of the end?
At least one would hope so. Of course, there are plenty obstacles in the horizon from the fact that there are many sides to this war in Syria to the fact that the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee passed a resolution accusing the Syrian government of war crimes. And yet, I would like to be hopeful here. I would like to think that what this demonstrates is that when there is when diplomacy is allowed to do its work and countries come together, success is achieved.
Jeffrey, this is it's a thing we've talked about before when we've discussed where a potential resolution might lie. Are we witnessing, I mean, this is just as it strikes me anyway, an ongoing process, I think, of the Western world trying to find a way to tactfully accept that Assad and Putin have basically won?
No, but I do. I would take Assad out of that. But I think that no, I would disagree. I think that this is more about Putin, actually. And I think as much as so much of the West distrusts him, reviles him, apart from Donald Trump, I think that what you've got to deal with the man in power in the Kremlin, particularly when he is as obstructionist and devious as Putin. And I think they had to really hold their noses and say, we can't do it without him. And so they brought him to the table, and he's playing his games, but he is essential in this equation. I would not say that Assad is necessarily secure as if this truce holds, but I think that it is, after 5 years, it's the first week where you can actually hold your breath and say, maybe there's an exit strategy or an end to this. But it is early days.
Well, Oscar, officially, the way forward is still that Security Council-endorsed roadmap for transition, allegedly over the next 18 months, which will involve Assad stepping down at some point, presumably for exile somewhere in Russia. Is that really something you can see Assad agreeing to, though, having sort of clung on for grim death for 5 years?
Look, I don't know if he will agree or not.
Or whether he'll have a choice.
Exactly. At some point, he won't have a choice. Exactly. That's that has been my point from the very outset. The roadmap is, in fact, being followed, and what we have seen this week proves it. The Russians have made enough suggestions that they're not entirely wedded to Assad, though, of course, they still defend the idea that regime change is not good for anyone. But we will see at some point a plan in which Assad is not seen as having been defeated, but he begins to fade out fairly quickly.
Jeffrey, one of the more interesting, interjections into the discussion this week was NATO Supreme Commander Europe General Philip Breedlove, who suggested that that Vladimir Putin was deliberately creating the refugee exflows from Syria as a weapon, a sort of Greek army without the wooden horse. How long would any truce need to be sustained realistically, though, before people start going home? Well, I mean, it's years, isn't it?
The scale of this refugee crisis is huge. I think the estimates are that 4 million of Syria's, what is it, 26 or 30
million? 22 million, I think, 20, before the war.
Yeah, have left. And many or most of them are in refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan or Turkey. I think that there's going to have to, don't forget their homes are gone too. The infrastructure, many of these cities have been flattened or at least raised good parts of them. So it's not like they can just go home and unlock the door in many cases. Interestingly, though, that is what people want to do. I think it's interesting that Canada, in accepting 25,000 Syrian refugees, actually had trouble finding people who wanted to go that far to that climate. They said, no, we really want to go home. There is an appetite, but I think we're some distance from that. I wouldn't want to be too optimistic. You have to also remember that Russia has a specific reason strategically for wanting to keep its finger in Syria. Its only Mediterranean naval port is the Tartus base in Syria that faces directly across from sits directly across from Cyprus. So this is not just about pieces on the chessboard. This is about or if it is a piece on the chessboard, it's a very important piece. Yeah. Putin needs strategically for Russia's pride and self-image and strategic global aspirations to keep some sort of control in Syria, and he will do what he has to do. And I agree with you. I don't think Assad is at all secure. I think it's just really a matter of when he becomes inconvenient, he goes.
Okay. Well, finally tonight, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has suggested during an interview with American television to be broadcast on Sunday that it might be preferable all round if the people of the United States had, and I quote, a little more awareness of what's going on in the rest of the world. This is, of course, a remark likely to prompt fury just as soon as Americans look up who Justin Trudeau is and where or what is Canada. Oscar, is this is a common trope, of course, this idea that Americans are ignorant and insular and don't travel and don't have an interest in the rest of the world. Is it any more or less lazy than caricaturing Canadians as a nation of overly polite hockey players?
Pardon me?
It is, of course, you know, playing to stereotypes is always a double-edged sword. You can say that some people might recognize some truth to those comments, but those comments are always always land in the wrong place. And coming from Justin Trudeau, who has been trying to set up Canada as a diplomatic example, this is a diplomatic faux pas.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Canada under his father, Pierre Trudeau, who really gave Canada a sense of being larger than having a larger place on the map. And I followed Expo 1967, which was this great World's Fair that really defined Canada's 100th birthday on the world stage. And then Trudeau came in 68 and really hung around for, well, better part of almost 13-14 years. And his son is so different. You know, he has the same name. Trudeau was an intellectual heavyweight, an arrogant SOB who would just never get elected today. Did a lot of very good things, but also did a number of very destructive things. Justin Trudeau is a real liberal, a small-L classic liberal. I'm not sure Jeremy Corbyn would be too uncomfortable with him. I don't think he's a socialist like Jeremy Corbyn, but this is a guy who really believes in modern values. And in many ways, if you're a liberal, it's really something to see, because he is the antithesis of American politics right across the border. But he's also a very good-looking guy with a gorgeous wife, and so he's been on the cover, is it Vanity Fair or GQ or whatever. They have become the kind of international darlings, and let them soak it up, let them enjoy it. It's, you know, why not? So being on 60 Minutes, a Canadian prime minister, that's a pretty good deal. And he might have committed a little faux pas, but I think he'll still get good attention. The question is, will there be the screaming crowds that his father used to get when he traveled?
I mean, where do you think this comes from, though, Oscar, this persistent thing that he is tapping into? Because obviously the United States is massively engaged with the rest of the world. People from all over the world live in the United States. The United States itself encompasses extraordinary cultural differences, at least, I would argue, as great as what you would find on continental Europe. Where does it come from, this idea?
You know, we're having a family debate on this, because I I lived in the United States for quite some time, and my sister lives in Canada. So we think that that the origin of this is that very, 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 very funny but very bad film called Canadian Bacon. I don't know if you will remember it, but
I do not.
That speaks to your good taste in cinema and my bad taste. But that's precisely the point. These equivocations do happen within families, and Canadians and Americans are one big family who might not recognize itself as such.
I mean, it really comes back to where this program began and Donald Trump and who's voting for Donald Trump. And, you know, when you talk about the insularity and what Trudeau's alluding to is in a rather indiscreet and undiplomatic statement, you know, America is a very big country that's quite self-sustaining economically and politically. And yes, of course, it is the global melting pot and has all of those internationalist virtues on one level. But who are these people voting for Trump? They're not people who want to know the nuance of the world. That's really what Trudeau's talking about.
It's probably worth noting that Justin Trudeau does have a spokesperson more diplomatic than he is. Also, during the interview, he makes references to an unnamed American presidential candidate candidate, rather, and suggests that he is somewhat deficient in foreign affairs. A spokesperson for Trudeau rather wonderfully said that she wasn't sure which candidate he was actually referring to. We will have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Eugenie Darras. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Up next, Carlotta Ribello with the Atlantic Shift at 1900. It's The Menu, also with Marcus Hippie. And there's more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time. It's 1800 London time. But for now, have a good weekend and goodbye.